We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 225. And Andrew, you know, I could do jokes, I could do bits, I could do anything. I'm just going to say, we got to just get to it.
Yeah. Yep.
We've been waiting two years for this moment. 2 years. Andrew has been saying elections have consequences. This is his famous quote he came up with, definitely on his own. And also, this is the next time we can make our opinion heard, really. It was 2 years of that, like after Trump. And finally, it happened. And we're here, and Andrew is recording from, again, some place that I don't even think is on Earth. I'm not sure what planet he's on. Longest trip ever. But he's still coming here to bring you that analysis. So how's it going, Andrew?
Yeah, Thomas, you recorded, I think, a really, really good episode of SIO yesterday. It's 165 that does sort of some instant reaction, and I think... well breaks down kind of the emotional roller coaster that was yesterday, especially for those of us who are 538 junkies and watching the live tracker. But obviously that leaves us with a whole lot of legal implications as a result of the midterm elections. And there's this certain matter of a new attorney general coming in.
Yeah. So I didn't even attempt to talk about that. I left that solidly. That's Andrew territory. So we got a lot to talk about today. So what do you say? Ready to get to it?
Yeah.
All right. Well, the first thing you have in our notes here is the Bradley effect. And I just wanted to, I had mentioned to you that I talked about that on my show. So I was going to just quickly say what I said on my show, and then you can, correct me if I'm wrong or give your interpretation, because this, I think, is most salient in the Florida election, because Andrew Gillum was a surprise loss. I mean, they're maybe going to do a recount, and we'll talk about that, of course, but he was solidly ahead on the polls. I mean, not by a huge amount, but consistently. I've got the poll history here on 538. Consistently, 2-3-4 point favorite, and then all of a sudden he loses, and people were speculating. I even saw on MSNBC, I think somebody was speculating as it was happening, like, oh, is this the Bradley effect? And the Bradley effect, for anybody who doesn't know, is roughly speaking, will people tell a pollster they're going to vote for a black person, but secretly they're not going to, probably because of racism or something like that? And could that account for, Andrew Gillum, who is black, leading in the polls and then losing at the last second? And I said, my opinion on that, my quick opinion, then we'll get right over to your analysis, is I don't think that's actually what happened, because of a couple reasons. Now, I'm not saying I'm 100% sure, but my feeling is that probably not, because nowadays, maybe it used to be a thing, but nowadays it is so easy for conservatives to just say, well, I don't like liberals. Like it's so easy for them. In fact, I've been having this argument with my family and other people about like how obvious it is that Trump is racist. And then for them, it's, oh no, any other explanation. Oh no, it's not this, it's this other thing. And I bring that up to say it's so easy for conservatives to just say, oh no, it's not, I'm not voting for Gillum because he's black. I just don't support liberals. And I don't think I don't think any conservatives that I know anyway, I don't know anybody who's compelled to say they're going to vote for a black liberal when they don't want to. Like, I don't know that that person exists anymore. I could be wrong. But also the one other thing that I think is a more solid piece of evidence that is not, you know, that was just my feeling. This is a more solid piece of evidence. Looking at the polling, the so 538 had a couple polls that were like last minute polls. So as I said, Gillum was consistently 2, 3, 4 points ahead. There's one poll, their last poll that came in November 4th and 5th, so just right before the election, that all of a sudden had DeSantis up 3. So something happened, I think, in the last minute that changed voters' minds. I don't think it was that they all of a sudden also decided to tell the truth to this polling company. And interestingly enough, the polling company is called Trafalgar Group. You could say, okay, is this just one biased poll that came out? But if you look at their previous poll, they did a poll a week earlier, the same polling company, and they had Gillum up 2. So the same polling company, polling group, 1 week later had a 5-point swing for DeSantis last minute. So in my opinion, I don't believe it's the Bradley effect that did it. I believe something changed people's minds last minute for Gillum, going away from Gillum rather. And honestly, I don't, that could also be racism, by the way. I don't know, but I don't know what that is. I think we need more data on that. But okay, what do you think? You were going to talk about the Bradley effect. That's my rant about it. What's your say?
No, that's a good rant. And I had put Bradley effect in quotes because I agree with everything that you've just said. I think particularly when we look to, you know, how Obama performed with respect to his polls, not just in the Democratic primary, but I mean, look, like Barack Obama was basically what launched Nate Silver out of Baseball Prospectus and into 538, right? Was correctly predicting the results of first the Democratic primaries in 2008 and then two presidential elections, in which our first African-American president performed exactly as you would expect given polling, right? So I agree with you. And let's also be clear that the original Tom Bradley, George Duke Majan race in California, that was a situation where Bradley was polling, I think, as much as 10 or 11. I think he had a double-digit lead the week before the election, and then Duke Majan squeaked out, I think by less than a point. Wow. So, you know, really, and then, you know, look, that was 30 years ago.
I was going to say, when was that? So I think since then conservatives have figured out to code racial language, like in politics, and wrap it up in other political issues so that it doesn't have to be like that, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
That's just my opinion.
Yeah. No, that was 1982. So 35 years ago, 36 years ago. But here's something. And this is the phenomenon that I just want to put on everyone's radar because it's going to be significant in 2 years is what I think some, it was not 538, but some pollsters were talking about the shy Trump voter effect, right, in 2016 to explain the polling differentials. And I kind of mocked that concept at the time. In fact, I think on our post-election mortem with Eli, like, I think I actually mocked it on that recording and said, yeah, oh yeah, right, because, you know, Trump voters are such shy people.
Yeah.
But I am beginning to think, we do not have enough data, but I am beginning to think that certainly in certain regions that there are people that underreport voting for Trump or Trump-aligned candidates that is kind of the akin to, you know, sort of a reverse Bradley effect.
You think it wouldn't make a difference if the opponent were black or not? It's more hidden.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is people who want to vote for Trump and Trump-backed candidates and who are embarrassed.
Yeah, and I certainly think there are many conservatives who are just conservatives, vote Republican, but have been iffy on Trump or Trump, you know, Trump like people. I think that's certainly real. You know, people are unsure. Maybe there's undecideds, and maybe statistically more of them last minute on the conservative side are like, oh, I just can't, you know, allow someone who's pro-abortion to get in office or something. And I could easily see that being an effect.
So Republican pollster Frank Luntz tells this anecdote in which he talks about having called up Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016 at about 5 p.m. and congratulated her on winning the presidency as a result of his exit polls. Right. And he says, here's how I got it wrong. And again, now look, it's Frank Luntz who is self-serving. So,
well, and it's also exit polls are problematic for different reasons. It's tough to know. But that's not this show. Listen to 538.
Yes. But here's what he says. He says, look, every year we have a certain number of people who tell us in the exit polls, you know, go clown horn yourself, right? Who decline to answer. And we just had a model, and it's like 3 or 4%. And we just had a model that, you know, allocates that out in proportion to the rest of the respondents. According to Luntz, for his internal exit polls, that was 11% in 2016. Wow. It was vociferous and angry, right? It was, you know, that's why I used the clown horn there, right? Like, it was not just, no, I declined to answer, but it was, hey, you know, what are you even doing here? And this is people talking to Frank Luntz, right? Like, you know, Republican pollster, not CNN. And his model allocated that, you know, 5.5, 5.5. And the people who refused to answer were 10.5 to 0.5, right? Like, it was, they were all Trump voters. They were all kind of aggressive about being on the record. So I heard that anecdote recently. And then, you know, as you're looking at Trump backed candidates that grossly overperformed their polling margins, it's something that I want to flag and put out there and say, basically, you know, when we're looking at elections having consequences, in preparing for 2020, prepare for Donald Trump to outperform his polling numbers. If Trump is within 2 or 3 points in a state going into the 2020 presidential election, if Trump-backed candidates are up by a couple, or you know, are down by a couple of points, I would be really, really nervous. And, you know, look, I'd love to be wrong on this. I'd love to say, you know, we have great numbers, but we've had two elections now where there are some results that certainly seem statistically anomalous, particularly in Florida and then in Midwest states. So, you know, in this case, in Indiana. And, you know, and that kind of fits in with the shy Trump voter. The idea is that, you know, in certain regions of the country, you may not be a shy Trump voter, but in other regions, you know, you might be. And I don't know. Yeah. We don't have enough data for that. But I wanted to put that out there because I kind of put those two things together. And it at least seemed plausible. It seems worth watching. And, you know, campaigning like you're down to instead of up to is always good political advice anyway. So I agree with you, Bradley.
All right, let's get to the legal consequence. Yep. You know what? I want to open it up, though. We kind of jumped ahead. Sorry, it's so much, and it's hard to know what we want to start with. But I just want to ask you, P. Andrew Torres, Esquire, how do you feel? I mean, we've been waiting for this for 2 years. How do you feel about what happened?
I feel very, very good about what happened. And I want to, and you know, and again, same emotional, mental roller coaster. Remember that the odds that the Republicans would hold the House were roughly equivalent to the odds that the Democrats would take the Senate. Right.
So, oh, right. Oh, okay. Yeah. And also to Trump winning in 2016, which is what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, all of that. Right. No. And I said to folks, you know, as the election results were starting to come in, of I'm not going to make the mistake I made in 2016, where I had assigned in my head a 0% probability.
Yeah.
That Donald Trump would win. I was like, okay, we got to figure out what happens if the Republicans hold the House. And what would have happened would have been catastrophic, right? It absolutely would have been disastrous. And we avert that. There are no more, you know, tax bills coming because revenue bills originate in the House of Representatives. We do not have to, you know, rely on the existence of the filibuster to prevent Trump from passing horrible legislation. We just have to block that legislatively. And the investigatory powers in the House are real and significant, and we are going to devote next Tuesday's episode to discussing that in significant detail. I'll give an early spoiler. Nice. Yeah, it is the return of Trump's tax returns. I want to talk about this one weird legal trick that the Democratic House can use.
Here's the one-liner I had that let me know if this was accurate. I said, imagine if it was Benghazi, except something bad actually happened, like something corrupt actually happened in Benghazi. Like, that's what we can try to make it like. Is that anywhere near? I mean, Benghazi was what, like 2-3 years of, how long was that?
It was forever.
Forever. Imagine all that, but actually there's a bunch of corruption and stuff.
Yep. And there is nothing that Donald Trump or the House Republicans, the minority of House Republicans now, can do about it. And that is a huge, huge victory. Yeah. It is particularly a huge victory in comparison to the binary alternative of Republicans holding the House.
Absolutely.
So I get that it doesn't feel, you know, like the blue wave, but I will point out, as we get to our next segment, the only reason that Donald Trump would want to seize the headlines 12 hours after election results come in by firing Attorney General Jeff Sessions is because he knows that those results were bad and that he was going to lose the news cycle and he needed to shift the narrative, right? This is what losing presidents do after an election in which their candidates have gone down. So
you think that's it? I thought it was just that he wanted to fire Sessions forever, but people just said, wait until the midterms because we don't want.
Oh, I do. I do. But look, if the Republicans had held the House, then Trump would have fired Sessions, you know, a week later. Right. Sessions would still be attorney general while you milk, you know, a week's worth of positive press.
Makes sense. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, the other thing that I wanted to talk about that happened on the ballot, I got a billion things on this list and, you know, we're not going to go through all of them. I did want to point out with respect to the bundled ballot initiatives in Florida.
Right.
We talked a little bit. Obviously, all of the headlines are on Florida's Amendment 4, which restores voting rights to 1.4 million Floridians, most of whom were convicted of nonviolent drug crimes. We've talked about that in the past. That's a real win for democracy. And oh, by the way, that turns out to be good for Democrats because Democrats are the party that want people to vote rather than not wanting people to vote.
Right.
Amendment 6.
I feel
passed.
Like that's that could be the yes. one of the biggest things in retrospect. That could be one of the biggest things of this election, because if Florida is so close, it's such a 50-50 state, and granting that many more people the right to vote could swing it in 2020.
Yep. And Democrats, as you pointed out on SIO, they did well in gubernatorial races, not, you know, knockout well, but they did well. And so in places like Wisconsin, where there would be an opportunity to continue to gerrymander congressional districts in 2020, that's going to be taken out of the hands of Republicans. So a lot of good things there. I did want to spend a few minutes on the follow-up to Florida's Amendment 6, which we talked about right before the election. That was the bundled amendment that combined extending the age for mandatory retirement for judges, plus victims' rights, plus the state-level Chevron deference, right? And that passed like 60-40 because Florida is insane and has this system that makes it impossible for people to vote competently. Electing DeSantis, by the way, means that all of our analysis about the Florida Judicial Nomination Commission, that goes out the window, right? That, you know, you've got a Republican governor who's going to replace 3 of the 7 Florida Supreme Court justices with arch conservative loons. Get ready to enjoy your state Supreme Court, Florida. Those people will also now serve 5 years longer, right? The same Amendment 6 is going to let them serve until 75 instead of 70. So it'll be even harder to replace them. I wanted to talk a little bit, since opening arguments is the official show of Chevron deference. I wanted to talk a little bit about what that means at the state level and why this is going to be a disaster, right? Because Chevron deference, what you think of in federal court, right, means executive agencies appointed by the president that are tasked with political jobs, right? And so the original Chevron case was about the Reagan era EPA rolling back Clean Air and Water regulations, right? And the question was, is it required that courts defer to the agency's interpretation if the delegation is ambiguous, right? So in other words, Congress says you've got to do X, and the executive agency doesn't do X, there's no deference. But Congress says, you have the authority to regulate breathable air and drinking water, and the agency says, right, and we determine that means not regulating air and and this is a gross oversimplification, but that the courts are required to defer to that agency's interpretation at the state court level. So right, you cannot affect how Chevron deference is applied to federal courts in Florida. I want to be very, very clear about this. The Florida amendment applies to proceedings in Florida state court, which now says that courts will review de novo, right, as a matter of first impression, all agency determinations. And let me explain in practical consequence, the primary way in which agency interpretations make their way into state court are when individuals challenge decisions by their local zoning boards, right? So what happens is I will say, I want to build this addition onto my house, right? I want to petition to make this street that's one way a two-way street. I want to get a variance. I want to get a special exception. I want something that allows me to do something with this piece of property that I can't otherwise do. And so you go to the zoning board and you argue before the zoning board. And in most of those cases, you lose. And in all of those cases, you're mad and you go to a lawyer and go, all right, well, now I want to sue, right? Because I went to the board, but this isn't the same as going to a court. And I want the board to have to answer for their decisions in court. And what lawyers will tell you, having litigated a lot of these cases, is no, look, like the courts are going to defer to the agency's determination of whether this was factually appropriate right. or not. So you're going to have to come up with something better than they made a mistake, right? And now, mind you, I had a case like this, right? I had a case in which I represented a developer who bought a fallow golf course, right? It's a golf course that had been abandoned for over a decade and was overgrown with weeds. And what the developer was going to do was had bought the property, was going to clear out the golf course and put in McMansions, right? Single family homes on half acre lots. And the day after my client bought the property, the county board met and rezoned only the area containing the golf course. I mean, literally, wow. The property my client bought, and they zoned it, they downzoned it from a particular classification, which was an R7, which would have allowed him to build on the half acre lots, right? To a woodlands preservation zone, which effectively, instead of allowing him to build 80 houses in this golf course, would have allowed him to build one. because in the woodlands preservation mode, you can only have a certain level of density and so that proceeding, right, we were able to go forward because we were able to say, look, like they convened a special session of the board and downzoned only my client's property and took away all economically
viable. Was that like corruption or just some weird
It was
grudge.
what it was, it was one council member responding to a complaint from one landowner. was one of her constituents who said, look, I live by this golf course and they're going to bring in all this earth mover equipment. And, you know, and again, I don't want to suggest that there are never, right? I mean, you know, I think my liberal cred is pretty well established on this show. It's valid to have considerations. But my point in telling the anecdote is that's the level at which it used to rise to bring these kinds of claims in mm-hmm. state court. The Florida courts are going to be flooded now, because now if you're a lawyer in Florida, but there's, by the way, free pro tip for anybody who's having problems attracting clients in Florida, go out and get disgruntled individuals who lose, you know, start, instead of ambulance chasing, start zoning board chasing. because now you can bring, it is a valid petition in the Florida state courts to say, no, zoning board just got it wrong. They should have, it will benefit the community to make this a two-way
street.
How
insane is this, though? This is what's so weird about Chevron deference. Like,
yeah.
I understand on some level having some amount of like unhappiness with how this might work. Like, oh, these executive agencies have too much power, that kind of thing. Like, I can kind of, you know, I can kind of understand that feeling. But the alternative of, therefore, the court is actually just going to make every decision now, like they have to look and micromanage all of these cases. What information are they using to make these decisions that's somehow better than the executive agencies? It's
worse, right? Like, because the information that they're going to have will be the record at the administrative agency, right? And testimony from various witnesses. That's it. Judges hate this kind of stuff. I know, having litigated this, regardless of where you are politically, as a judge, you look at this and go, I'm not well equipped to decide whether a road should be two ways or one way. Like, I'm a judge. I want to defer to this administrative agency. And so it's going to be really, really interesting the way that gets put into practice, because look,
yeah, I was going to say, let me ask you this. Could an individual judge just still do that? Like, still be like, I'm deferring, or just, I mean, I guess they could make the decision to always go with whatever the agency, like, how does this make a judge not do that?
So here's what it does. You cannot control a judge's mind. Right. So the
I've
judge
tried.
Right. Yeah. No, believe me. Yeah, we've got the goat sucker from the Al Pacino movie. Right. where we got the lawyer to stutter. So you can't control what the judge does in their head. But what this does control is what you can argue in your briefs. Right. It's greatly going to increase the workload, because now if you're a lawyer, right, previously, if the standard is deference to the administrative agency's findings, you know, as a lawyer, you don't go in there and overload your briefs with a ton of additional facts, because there's no point in relitigating the facts unless the administrative agency was clearly erroneous, right? That's gone. And so now it is the lawyer's duty to relitigate the facts in every single case. And the judge can't say to you, Mr. Torres, I don't care about this. This was already decided at the lower court level, right? They can ultimately still defer. And I believe that as a practical matter, that there probably will be a lot of that unofficial deference, but the workload is going to be enormous, and this is, you know, this is an example of where the political effort to make something happen is going to overwhelm kind of the practical consequences, because, you know, as you point out, right, judges are not equipped to make these kinds of decisions. They don't want to make these kinds
of
decisions.
But so really, I guess what it really does is it just enables whichever super conservative judges do happen to get this opportunity to be able to make the choice however they want it.
And remember, right, we're talking about a a process, right? So it will also enable super liberal state judges to come in and as a matter of first impression say, nope, we are concerned about the environmental impact here, so I'm going to bring this development project to a halt, right?
I mean, that's another thing. Like, once Republicans open this Pantera's box, then we have to use it too. I mean, it's another battlefield now. It's another like axis of, you know, war in politics. So we have to use it to try to, otherwise it will just get trampled.
And it is why I described in my debate, I continue to do so, my judicial philosophy as sort of small C conservative, right? Like, this is, it would be better to have procedural rules in place that keep the court, that keep the courts out of these kinds of decisions. And, you know, we see which
right.
side
I mean,
is,
I can't think of anything more judicially active, right. you know, activist as what Republicans think they're against. This is. Seems to me as just that. This is just judicial activism.
Yep, exactly right.
All right. I didn't imagine that we would be doing a deep dive into Chevron deference. But given that Chevron deference is a sponsor of the show, we are kind of required to work it in. It's the official obscure legal concept of opening arguments.
Plus,
Thomas and Andrew, enjoy a good tall glass of Chevron deference.
Plus, we needed to drag out to the B segment before we talked about the firing of Jeff Sessions. So
Hold on. Before we do that, I need to know about these recounts, Andrew, because we got potential recounts happening. I don't, from my memory, I think you've done a deep dive on this some time ago. It strikes me that we're putting a lot of hope into this on the left, when what it really is like the recount in The Simpsons, where it's Martin is elected student president or something.
One vote for Martin?
Yeah.
Two votes for Martin.
It's just two votes, like one for Martin, two for Martin.
Yeah.
It strikes me as kind of that, where do you see any hope or chance of significant changes? Now, it's one thing, by the way, in I think Georgia and maybe some other places, there are a bunch of ballots that just haven't been counted yet. That's, of course, you know, it's fair to hold out some hope for that kind of thing. But in terms of recounts, what are the odds that it's going to change?
So recount laws are vary state by state. Delightfully, for example, Scott Walker has lost in Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin law that Scott Walker put into place increased the threshold for mandatory recounts, thus putting him outside the recount range.
So great.
So so hoist by one's own petard in that case. No, you are 100% correct. Recounts almost never change what happens. And we've talked about all the reasons for that in the past. You wouldn't expect a situation in which that could happen. There are a number of states in which there seem to be a huge chunk of votes that are still outstanding. So in particular, Arizona remains uncalled. I would not pin a lot of hopes on any of these. In Arizona, as of this morning, there are 500,000 uncounted votes in Maricopa County. Maricopa County is the county that includes Phoenix, which is a rather large city for Arizona. And you have to think that those are a significant slug of Democratic votes. Whether that is going to be enough to allow Kyrsten Sinema to overtake Martha McSally, I wouldn't hold out a lot of hopes for that. I will tell you, Thomas, as you know, and as anyone who follows the Opening Arguments Twitter knows, what would have been enough would have been if everybody who voted for the Green Party candidate who withdrew 3 weeks ago had voted for Sinema instead, then she would have a comfortable
I'm
lead.
So but, beyond thinking yeah. those people are in any way reachable. I think what also could have happened that would be more reachable is people who just didn't vote for whatever reason, who forgot, who didn't care, who didn't. The Green Party people are so ill-informed and just misguided that I would They're like the last people that I even care about trying to reach.
Yep. So that's open in Arizona. You talked about two races that are potentially headed to a runoff. The first, and I want to kind of button this down, is the Senate election in Mississippi. Both of these are cases where there is a required runoff if the prevailing candidate does not hit 50%. And so in Mississippi, the Democratic candidate, a strong candidate certainly for Mississippi, Mike Espy, former Clinton Secretary of Agriculture, got 41% of the vote. And then so did Cindy Hyde-Smith, the Republican, who's a third-party candidate in there that accounted for the balance. So nobody was over 50. That's going to go to a special election. But all of those votes that went third-party, well, all of them, the overwhelming majority of those votes are going to go Republican. So that Senate seat is not going to be a pickup.
However, if you are in Mississippi, you get another crack at voting. You know, make it happen. It's just as important as it was last week. What do you think about, because I think if the Stacey Abrams one, if there's any way she could get to a runoff, it seems to me from my understanding that would be critical. That would be potentially huge because of how much voter suppression there was going on, how many weird things her opponent was doing, that the runoff would be under very different circumstances than Tuesday.
I think that's exactly right. It's why I saved it for the end.
No.
Like that's good. Let's go to it. This is a super, super interesting race. I'm going to put in the show notes. We tweeted it out. If you voted via provisional ballot in Georgia, call the Democratic vote line and ensure that your provisional ballot is being counted, because what's going on in the Stacey Abrams race is that she's running against the Republican Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, and he's the one who controls all of the access and the rules. Any ethical person, any remotely ethical person, would have recused himself in this situation. So, of course, he did not. And one of the things that Kemp has not released is the number of provisional ballots that are outstanding, the number of provisional ballots that have been counted. And so with the totals that we have right now, Kemp has 50.3% of the vote. That number has to get under 50%, right? So a 0.4% swing, that is in the tens of thousands. We don't know how many valid voters were forced to vote provisionally. We don't know how
can they,
many.
I mean, yep. Can they sue? I mean, there's got to be. This just seems insane that they could just be withholding information or not telling us. I mean, do you see potential lawsuits as being successful there?
Being successful, I don't know. I see potential lawsuits if the information doesn't come out. We will know more. Sadly, we will know more after this show is recorded.
Tell you
margin,
what though.
Yeah.
Good on Stacey Abrams. Stay in it. Fight. Make sure every vote is counted. Don't pull an Al Gore. Like I'm really glad she's doing that, you know.
Yep. And you're right in the sense that usually runoff elections tend to favor Republicans. But really what they do is they favor the party whose voters are more energized, right? Because look, there's an actual cost in going out and getting to the polls, and then you've got to do it twice, right? You're like, oh gosh, I just did that. And so the voters who tend to be able to do that are voters that tend to have demographics that match up well with being Republican, right? And so runoff elections under normal structural conditions favor Republicans. Given the Abrams race, that that very well could buck the trend. And so if you want a sign of optimism, that would be where I would sort of pin my most optimistic hopes. I do not think it is possible. I know Bill Nelson has said that he is calling for a recount in his Senate race against Rick Scott. It looks like the numbers there are under half a percentage. So Florida has, a lot of states have a 1% recount threshold. Florida has a half a percent. And so it looks like that race is headed to a recount. Again, I would not pin a lot of hopes on a recount overturning large numbers. I would say we've lost that seat, but there may be the potential to go to a runoff election in Georgia, and I think there's still an awful lot of excitement for Stacey Abrams, and I think if that is triggered based on shenanigans by Kemp, who has been, you know, roundly criticized already, you know, that look, those are good conditions. So that's where we stand with, look, there are a dozen races that are very, very close, of which the overwhelming majority favor Democrats in the House. We obviously don't have time to go through them one by one. At the end of the day, the much maligned 538 tracker has Democrats picking up 37 net seats in the House. That's a 9%+ swing. So that kind of brings us back full circle. This was a big, the reasons in which it is not a blue wave, are the reasons we have described. They are constrained by gerrymandering, right? The Democrats, if we'd only won by 3.5 points, would not have retaken the House.
Oh, we would have lost. Yeah.
And that's ridiculous. Right? So, a 9%+ swing is a major, major swing among the electorate.
It is. I have more thoughts, but I did them on SI. I have more thoughts about the waves and all that. If you want to check that out, please do. I won't do it here because we need to hear what Andrew has to say on Jeff Sessions. Hey, listeners, I'm really excited to talk to you about Audible because I have used Audible for years. I absolutely love it. A big theme of our podcast is learning stuff we didn't know, Andrew teaching us, all that kind of thing. I listen to so many audiobooks on Audible because I love learning. I really do. It's something I'm passionate about. And there is no better place to listen and learn than Audible, because now Audible members get even more exclusive audio fitness programs, audiobooks, Audible originals, and more. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet. And now with Audible originals, the selection has gotten even more custom with content made for members. The book I'm currently listening to is called Identity Crisis. It is, I think, from what I'm hearing, maybe the best analysis of 2016 and the election and American identity and all the confluence of all those things. It's really fascinating. I highly recommend it. I'm sure you've probably heard about it. It's been causing a bit of stir because it's such an interesting analysis. Check it out. And if you sign up for Audible, every month you get one credit good for any audiobook you choose, plus two Audible originals from a changing selection that you can't get anywhere else. You also get access to audio fitness and health workouts created exclusively for Audible. Plus, these books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership. Didn't like your audiobook? Exchange it with no questions asked. So go check it out right now. Start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. That's a free book, free learning. It's great. audible.com/lawpod. Or you can text LAWPOD to 500500 to get started. That's audible.com, audible.com/lawpod, LAWPOD, or text LAWPOD to 500500 to get started. All right, we also just wanted to plug real quick Vulgarity for Charity over on The Scathing Atheist and Cognitive Dissonance, two great podcasts that, of course, I'm sure everybody knows about, but if you don't, check them out. They have, I think it's every year, right? They raise a tremendous amount of money for a charity that's called Modest Needs, which I think, and Andrew, tell me if you agree, I think that's a really great charity because it helps people who maybe just need temporary assistance for like a family emergency or a crisis, or they need to a little money here or there. I think it's a great charity. What are your thoughts on Modest Needs?
So I love Modest Needs. We both of us have donated to Modest Needs in the past. The way it works is they do sort of impact intervention, right? Like we've talked about on the show how half of the population is basically living paycheck to paycheck. So, you know, that includes things like folks who can't pay to turn on the heat in the winter and you know, people who have unexpected medical bills because of the crisis we have in healthcare. I mean, all the things that, you know, if you listen to this show, you probably care about along with us. And what Modest Needs does is they pay the creditors directly, right? So there's zero vetting. There's zero, like, you know, maybe this is some kind of a scam on a crowdfunding. Their overhead is super low. They're a tremendous charity. And they work with vulgar podcasters. So, you know, that is that's kind of a price of admission. So I know folks always complain about the clown horns on this show.
yeah. There's no clown horns on Vulgarity for Charity. No, there are not. If it were on this show, it would probably just be a long 60-minute horn, basically. So
yes, yes, yes. So if you want to know why I will never be on the Supreme Court and you want to hear Thomas and I take some shots at people, all in good fun and all for charity, yeah, head on over to The Scathing Atheist and to Cognitive Dissonance. And by the way, like, participate in Vulgarity for Charity. We've already had some OA listeners. If you donate at the $50 level or above, you can request that Thomas and I give your roast of choice. And, oh man, we've already done some ones that, that rip my heart out a little bit. So, it's a great.
I didn't really do any, but that's what Andrew did. Andrew came hard. You got to check it out. So really good stuff. We love those guys, of course. So go check it out. We'll put the link in the show notes. Vulgarity for Charity 2018.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse. I know you have to get up and ask a question, so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All right, Andrew. So Jeff Sessions immediately fired. I mean, he resigned, but, you know, obviously fired. He didn't want, he never would have left that job voluntarily, I think. Wow. Pretty big deal, it seems to me. It made me very nervous. I remember you had said, and I want to hear your answer right here. So I'm like the SNL fake commercial where the Democrats are like, it's a wave, and they're all nervous. You had said that if we win the House, Mueller's investigation is safe, right? Right? And that still applies even with this firing and whatever Trump's going to do, right?
Mueller's investigation is safe. Everything now,
even with a lame duck period, we're not in power yet.
Even with a lame duck period, okay.
Everyone
take a deep breath, and I want to walk through all of this and
build
look,
coffee all over
yeah,
myself.
No, yeah, I know a lawyer who can represent you in that. Let's start with this premise, right? Which is everybody is assuming, and look. I am no fan of Matt Whitaker, right? Sessions, chief of staff, Trump loyalist, everybody knows, wrote an article saying Mueller has gone too far and was named acting attorney general. I want to point out the people making this argument are saying, God help us, Jeff Sessions, right? Are saying, oh, we need the principled, independent leadership of Jeff Sessions to protect us from Matt Whitaker.
Okay. I feel implicated in this because I you know, I'm going to defend myself. Uh-huh. I hate Jeff Sessions. He's evil. You know, like his policies are awful and all that. However, he did recuse himself. And the person that he, and what's Whitaker is. Not only, unless somehow he's forced to do that, I don't think he's going to do that. And that's another question I have for you. I'm sure people are wondering, can he be forced by the Justice Department to do that? Or can he just say, nah? And he is, I mean, the he's almost a conspiracy theorist. Well, he might actually be a conspiracy theorist with regard to the Russia investigation. I mean, yes, I hate Jeff Sessions, but I'm not, there shouldn't be any GoFundMe for Jeff Sessions or anything that we've done. And I have to just throw in the funniest friggin' Onion headline ever, which was, a depressed Jeff Sessions tries to commit suicide by smoking a joint.
I thought you were going to go with the Onion headline of, Jeff Sessions is the only Confederate monument that Donald Trump is willing to tear down.
Also good. Really good.
But no, let me.
So answer all that.
I'm going to. We're gonna do all that. Remember that Sessions surprised us, right? I expected Jeff Sessions to be a rubber stamp hack, and he was somebody who turned over, who recused himself and turned over the Mueller investigation to Rod Rosenstein, who, you know, you recall my enthusiasm for Rosenstein from day one.
Well, just to be precise, he turned over the Russia investigation to Rosenstein, who then hired Mueller,
correct,
right?
Correct. That is the precise way of putting it. Yes. And so it is possible, right? Everybody is saying, right, Whitaker is a hack and a conspiracy theorist, right? Sessions is a racist and a birther and a monster, right? So it is possible. Let's keep an open mind about this, that it is possible Whitaker is not there to try and gut the Mueller investigation.
What?
I'm not saying I want to have a huge ton of optimism. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I have 0% chance for me on that. But that's just
but
me.
What percent would you have put on Sessions, right?
Well, no, I think with Sessions, I think he's an old guy, right? I mean, he is a Confederate monument. I think he was just slightly slow on the uptake to the fact that the rules don't apply anymore.
Well,
I think he was like a little bit behind. It was like, oh, wait, I totally, every single rule and norm in the world is telling me, and he's been a senator for a while, right? Or he was. And he's like, every norm and rule in the world is telling me I should recuse myself. All right, I guess I have to do that. And then, like, he probably realized 10 minutes later, he did a Homer Simpson, like, dope, I didn't realize that none of the rules applied anymore and you could do whatever you want. That's my feeling on why that happened, but I could be wrong.
All right, so now let's move down. Why do we have Whitaker and not G. Zachary Terwilliger? Right?
Yeah, what happened to our favorite opening arguments character, G. Zachary Terwilliger?
So here's what happened, right? And again, remember, G. Zachary Terwilliger was the person who would assume the position of deputy attorney general if Trump had fired Rosenstein rather than firing Sessions, right? Which, in the ordinary course, when you fire the attorney general, the deputy attorney general becomes the acting attorney general. That's why he's the deputy attorney general. But that brings us back to our favorite statute that has been employed to considerable effect by the Trump administration, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act of 1998,
right,
which is 5 U.S.C. 3345. We've talked about this before. It allows the president to bypass the ordinary norms of succession and appoint a temporary successor in the event of a vacancy. However, the one thing that the president can't do, right, under the clear language of the statute, is the president cannot create a vacancy and then appoint someone to fill that vacancy. So let's talk about the specific language of 5 U.S.C. 3345. It says, if an officer of an executive agency, right, which includes the attorney general, whose appointment to office is required to be made by the president, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, quote, dies, resigns, or is otherwise unable to perform the functions and duties of the office, then the president may name an interim successor. Firing Jeff Sessions is not the same as him dying, resigning, or being otherwise unable to perform the functions and duties of his office.
He could have stopped this. He had power to just stay in the office, right?
So I think there is still a potential claim here. And let me explain, because Trump has done this once before. Okay. In March of this year, Trump fired the Secretary of the Veterans Affairs Department, okay, a guy named David Shulkin. And then he named a Pentagon undersecretary, a guy named Robert Wilkie, to serve as acting secretary, right? And you can do that because of the provisions of the FVRA. After Shulkin was fired in court, right? So veterans groups challenged Wilkie's ability to serve as acting secretary under the FVRA. And they made the argument that I am making to you right now. You can't fire Shulkin, create the vacancy, and then appoint Wilkie to fulfill that vacancy. If you do, if you fired him, then just ordinary succession rules apply. And in court, the administration argued that Shulkin had not been fired. And the only reason to make that argument, which then mooted out the case, is if the administration is tacitly acknowledging that the Vacancies Reform Act does not allow them to fill that position when they have fired and created the vacancy in the first place. Now,
right.
I don't need to. And Shulkin, by the way, capitulated and said, "Oh yeah, I really resigned." Sessions, I doubt, is going to go along with that argument. And so I expect to see that someone will file a lawsuit and challenge the appointment of Whitaker as acting attorney general under the FVRA. The question begins, who has standing to do that? And you know who would have standing to do that? Special counsel Robert Mueller.
Wow.
And so I don't know what's going on right now, but I do know that if Whitaker comes in and calls up Mueller and says, you're fired, right? Pack everything up and get out of town, then absolutely, it is crystal clear to me that Mueller could go to court.
Oh, he could go to the court that has all the Republicans in it.
So now you might ask, right, what does ultimately all the way up to the Supreme Court? The last time the Supreme Court interpreted the Federal Vacancies Reform Act was a case called NLRB versus Southwest General. It was a 6-2 decision. And the two on the bottom, by the way, were Sotomayor and Ginsburg, construing the FVRA narrowly. It had a very, very different set of issues around it. But basically, the Roberts majority opinion, joined by not just the conservative members of the Supreme Court, but by two liberals as well, held that the FVRA should not be interpreted in light of legislative history, should not be interpreted by looking at congressional testimony and by looking at the, but should be construed on the basis of the plain meaning of the words themselves. And under that analysis, it is very, very difficult to say that creating a vacancy, right, firing somebody is the same as them resigning. Now, there will be a fact question, and I suppose a lower court could say resigns includes, you know, being pressured to resign. But we are not without potential recourse if Whitaker decides to go nuclear option on Mueller. That will not be the only argument that Mueller could raise, by the way, because the special counsel's authority, he can be removed by the attorney general only under, quote, misconduct, dereliction of duty, incapacity, conflict of interest, or for other good cause, end of quote. Now, again, you know, as you pointed out,
doesn't all of this fail if the Supreme Court is corrupt enough?
If the Supreme Court is corrupt enough not to care, then, you know, yeah.
Then all of this fails. But I guess we're probably not quite there yet. However, for some reason, Ruth Bader Ginsburg left her cryogenic freezing chamber. What? Why is she in any position to fall? There shouldn't be any gravity being applied to her. Who is in charge of Ruth Bader Ginsburg? There shouldn't. She should be in a room of pillows and health food or something. I don't.
Yes.
We're one. Yeah. We're a couple more Ruth Bader Ginsburg's ribs away from the get being beyond hope in my opinion.
And let me say that, and, you know, particularly for anyone who's had, you know, elderly family members fall, that it can very often lead to a cascade, right? Like it can be. Now my grandmother fell, who is 92, fell 6 or 7 years ago, and she's been, you know, she has been
writing jurisprudence, right, ever
serving
since
on the Supreme Court ever since. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily, it could be very, very bad. One final note that I want to add. There are a ton of articles, from multiple sources. I think the most prominent is in, New York Magazine, suggesting that, Mueller's investigation is about to indict Donald Trump Jr. That obviously would be a major.
I feel so bad for my heart goes out.
If I just want to be clear, if Donald Trump or anybody who works for Donald Trump interferes with the Mueller investigation in order to protect Donald Trump Jr., that is obstruction of justice. That falls under 18 U.S.C. 1512. Subsection C2 says that it is the crime of obstruction of justice to, quote, corruptly obstruct, influence, or impede any official proceeding or attempts to do so. And so that is a broad-based provision. It very, very clearly applies to the president, notwithstanding the fact that our good buddy Alan Dershowitz has said that it does not, you know, has taken the, when the president does it, it is not illegal. It even though, right, because that's why the word corruptly is in there, right? Because there are things that you could do that would obstruct justice that, if you do not have corrupt intent, would not be an obstruction of justice, right? You know, if I drop my cell phone and step on it because I'm clumsy, in order to, you know, and it destroys the hard drive and I have data that is relevant to an investigation on it, right? Like that, it matters whether I've stepped on it by accident, right? There's no law against stepping on your cell phone. There is a law against corruptly obstructing, influencing, or impeding any pending any official proceeding, and if the wheels are in place, and we have every reason to believe, if not Donald Trump Jr., lots of wheels are still nevertheless in place, then that counts. So it is. Look, I agree with you. I was not pleased to see Sessions being fired. I was doubly not pleased to have to pin my hopes on judicial, on the current Supreme Court. But, you know, this is a legal podcast. We are going to continue. I am going to continue under the impression that at some point the law actually does matter.
I guess we kind of have to. It's sort of in our branding. Kind of.
Look, if proven wrong, I'll come out and we'll, you know, we'll call that out.
We'll just start doing opening anarchy. We'll all just kind of volunteer what we think the rules will be.
That'll be our new show. My tagline of opening nothing. So, but I want to talk about all of the good things that the Democratic-controlled House of Representatives can and will start doing in 2019. And part of that includes protecting the Mueller report. You're going to have to wait till Tuesday to hear about that one, though.
Ooh, what a good tease. I love it. All right, well, it is time for us to thank our top patrons over at patreon.com/law. I don't know why I blanked for a second. I was going to say /opening argument. patreon.com/law. These are the truly fine, fine people who make the show happen. I hope they enjoy all their goodies each and every month and their bonus episodes, and also getting to change your name and say funny stuff, make us say funny stuff. And we have to thank, of course, wordorigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. And we begin with shouting up, up, and OA from the top of Yodel Mountain. Oh, what a good one. Way to come in strong with your first, finally that person reached a month, I think. So coming in strong with a shout out there. McKinney ISD is run by bigoted dominionists. I don't know what that is, but okay. Mistel and Company, Hall of Fame patron whose clever name didn't get read last week. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. All right. Hey, you get your plug. That's what happens. And just in case that comment before, you do have to be at this level for at least 1 month's worth of the pledge to get the name read. Otherwise, you're over on the new patron. So that's how we work it here. The Registry Matters podcast. Zabby, Abacus Finch. Sessions is an unattractive distractor. Ooh, you hit that right on time. Perfect. Attractive distractor. Docket scientist wearing only a pair of amicus briefs. Brian Studwell. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew is a close second. Nice. Well, even after I blew it on TTTB 100. Thank you. Ryan. No, 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 no. Blank Boxman. What's the use of feeling blue? Kurt Robinson, Cosmo, the karaoke legend formerly known as Pete Barrington. Californians, vote no on 6, stop National GOP's attack on road and transit funds. And good news for you, patron, even though you need to change your name because it's too late to vote on that. But good news, it sounds like the voters did what you wanted them to do. We stopped 6 from what I'm seeing, so good on us. Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Yodely McYodelface. They're very fine people on both sides of TTTV.
Nice.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away? Sam Buck, the other Michael Cohen. Milo Mead song, the Halfling Bard and SIU 3L. Getting Off podcast. 2 wrongs don't make a right, but 3 rights make a left. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. 4 boxes of Liberty soap, ballot, jury, and ammo. Use in that order. Starry Decisis from the top rope, brother. Truck Fump. Mike the Intactivist. James sure hopes that elections have consequences. Yeah. Rob Schreck. I knew Romney would win, but I voted for Jenny Wilson anyway.
Well, there you go.
Daylin Lee, same as Grix. Brian Upshaw's Last Chance For-Profit Prison. Japan Dan. Buttercup the Cat, official TTTBE Gate Council to Thomas Smith. Thank you. I think we won all of that. I think Andrew owes me a hefty... can I get some sort of a bonus point out of that? No, it's too late. I missed it. I messed it up. 59 out of 100. I have to accept it. Anonymous, beer, beer, beer. I like beer, beer, beer. Me likey beer, drink beer. Attorney doll relationship. Saudi Arabia assassinations and more LLC. Squint finger. Vote democratically. No. Vote democratically for a Democrat to preserve democracy. Take it away, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you, too. Join me. Give more to podcasters in December or January. Happy holidays. That's terrific advice. Ooh,
not arguing with that.
The Eastern District Crunchwrap Supreme Court. I still love that one. Andrew Torres and Thomas for President, AT&T 2020. Wigged Hitch Runt. Clownhorn Patreon for insisting on adding a county in my profile. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Enjoy the discriminating taste of Yodel Mountain Brew Company Jeff Sessions Ale.
Ooh, gonna have to find a new one now.
Holy Diver. What's a better Yodelbots villain, Deceptitrumps or Detrumpticons? Oh, I'm going to have to go with Detrumpticons on that one. I like that one. Timey Kangaroo Down Sport. Hopefully that's a decent Australian accent for you there. Living in a slightly brighter timeline. Yes, exactly right. Saul, an anagram of Spiro Agnew, is grow a penis. Very true. Jeremiah has internalized that the Brewers won their division. Big easy blasphemy. A string of unpronounceable characters. I set the bar too high with a funny name last week. Yeah, big problems. Legalize the purge. Andrew's rusty abacus. Brandon Smith. Now making political donations based on Thomas Smith's recommendation. Well, we got more coming for you. More of a blue splash than a blue wave, but that's still a win. Rhonda, the rigged witch hunter. Malika Chandler. Abacus Flinch. Soggy Pants. CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Springfield Dog Track. Think of them as little horses. Oh, that's a quality Simpsons reference there. Sam Donow. Greg Sullivan. Remember that time Catholics tried to blow up the government?
Thank you, God. I hate that so much when people romanticize that stupid thing. It was just some religious nut jobs. All right. Sorry.
Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Matthew Vernon. Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. Aaron Grady. If only keeping children with their parents was as popular as weed. Wow. That's depressing. Yeah. Ian and Allie.
Harsh.
St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers. Sakashite Fukusumi. This is perhaps the end of the beginning. Nice. Jim Grove, Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, Wobblers, Bobblers, and Wicked Knob Gobblers, LLP. What's a movie we could make Aaron watch that he'd hate? Oh, that's a great idea. opening arguments, Caravan, Invading Your Country, Nunk Pro Tunk. Mormon J. Fox, and our all-time Hall of Fame best, number one, never to be dethroned, but keep trying to dethrone him, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much for supporting us over at patreon.com/law. And I do want to give a second shout out to Mistel and Company. I think they were left out of a Hall of Fame reading, and for that we greatly apologize.
Well, you got to get to that threshold for the reading. Yep, I think cool. That might have been it.
Glad they're on board now, though. So.
Absolutely. All right. And you know what? We've gone too long and we reached TTTBE 100 and I'm still, you know, I'm still in a funk. I'm still actively depressed about missing that question that I should have gotten. I'll probably never get over it. So we're going to take a week off of TTTBE. I need to regroup. I need to evaluate my study habits, which are not studying. I think I need to change my approach. So we're over long already. So I think we'll take a little break.
Here's what I'd like to do for listener participation this week. Retweet out this episode and retweet the subject matter that you want me to ask Thomas for TTTBE number 101. So if you're feeling generous, you could say constitutional law, where Thomas tends to do pretty well. If you're feeling masochistic, you could stick him with another real property question. Do you know, share it out. Tell us what kind of question you want me to hit Thomas with.
All right, but there's still going to be a finite number of real property. Like, this isn't going to... Like, if they have me do a real property one right away, it's not like you're finding an extra real property.
I'll go find an extra one.
No, damn it. That's not... Sanctity of the game goes both ways.
All right.
You know, we both have moral obligations here.
No, that's a fair point. Well, let's see what the listeners say.
If the exam were 250 real property questions, I would get a 2% on it. Like, that's... I'm not... That's a great idea for participation, though. Cast your vote if you're a fan of not making me suicidal, then definitely choose anything but real property. And if you don't like me, then choose real property. So we'll see. It's a referendum on me. No, it's okay. It's all in good fun. All right. Thank you so much for listening. Hey. And you know what? I said this on my show, but just to cover it here too, a strong pat on the back and thank you and sincere gratitude and everything like that for everybody who went out and voted, who did anything like knocking doors, calling, or donating, or anything like that. Because you know what? As much as I had some depressing thoughts about the election, it still was a win. We still got back the House. And as you said, Andrew, you said it, it would have been an absolute clown horn disaster for that not to have happened. It would have been the end of so much. So we did it. We made it happen. You guys played a huge part in that. Congratulations. It was a long 2 years and we won something.
I couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. We'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.